It can be very disconcerting when we compare ourselves to God. This is a really stupid little story. I'm almost embarrassed to begin the talk with it. You won't find it in the Bible. But the story goes that a young man was having a conversation with God. And he says to God, "God, how long is a million years to you?" And God said, "A million years to me is just like a single second to you." So the young man says, "All right, God, well, what's £1 million like to you?" And God said, £1 million to me is just like a single penny to you." So the young man, feeling slightly cheeky, says, "All right then, God, can I have one of your pennies?" And God says, "Certainly, just a second." It can be very disconcerting when we compare ourselves with God, and the young man we've just read about finds himself in exactly the same situation, because for the very first time in his life, as far as we know, he finds himself comparing his own goodness to the goodness of God. Just look at what happens there in Mark chapter 10, verse 17. You can see it on your piece of paper. "As Jesus started on his way, a man ran up to him and fell on his knees before him." Now, just to say, we know a little bit about this man's background from other books in the Bible. So it's Matthew who tells us that the man was young, and it's Luke who adds the detail that this man was a ruler of some kind. In other words, he had authority. So to put it another way, he has everything going for him. He's young, he is rich, and he is powerful. I guess he's exactly the kind of guy that most people aspire to be, if we're being honest. But there is something dark and ominous on this man's horizon, because he knows, this man, he knows that very soon old age and death will make his youth wither, his power powerless, and his money worthless. He may be young, but he's not naive. He knows death will take those things forever. Now, I guess all of us in this room have our own story to tell, but for me, my first really shattering encounter with death came 5.5 years ago as I watched my mother slowly die of stomach cancer in a hospice in Surrey. And she was only 64, and it was September the 16th, 2001, when she died. And of course, we all know what happened 5 days before that on September the 11th. And the lesson I learned that week, and this may seem blindingly obvious, it is blindingly obvious, but I didn't see it up to this point. And here it is: no one lives forever. No one. Not even the ones we love the most. And not even the young, the rich, and the powerful. Those young men and women who got up, as usual, that Tuesday morning to go to work in the most beautiful building, in probably the most beautiful city in the world, and had no idea that before their Tuesday morning was up, they would be standing before their Creator and giving an account of their lives to Him. And this young man craves the kind of life that will never be killed by cancer, or turn to ashes on an ordinary Tuesday morning at the office. He craves eternal life. And the craving is so powerful that verse 17, he actually runs up to Jesus and falls on his knees before him. Just look at verse 17, look at what he says. "Good teacher," he says to Jesus, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And it's so important to notice something here about the man's question. Did you notice that the man thinks there is something that he can do to inherit eternal life, as if eternal life is something that can be earned from God by doing good things. And, you know, I don't think that mindset is unusual. I remember meeting a guy last year in Minneapolis, and he said to me, it just stuck in my mind, he said, "If you want a helping hand in life, you'll find it at the end of your own arm." That was his whole life philosophy. You know, if you want something out of life, you have got to earn it. Even if it's the approval of God, you've got to earn it. As Jago was saying, we run a course here called Christianity Explored, and it's based on this book of Mark we're looking at right now. And one of the discussion starters we have on the course is this, and it might be useful if maybe you just answer this in your own mind as I say it. We say to people, look, if you were to die tonight, and God were to say to you, "Why should I let you into heaven?" What would you say? Now, you may not believe there even is a God, but just indulge me for a moment. If God were to say to you, why should I let you into heaven? How would you respond? Just instinctively, how would you respond? And just to say, we get all kinds of responses to that. Some people say, well, you know, on the whole, I think I'm a pretty good person. God, you should let me into heaven because I'm pretty confident the good things I've done outweigh the bad. Some people say, God, you should let me into heaven because I care about the environment. I'm a caring person. I recycle. I give to charity. I buy fair trade. I offset my carbon emissions. That's why you should let me in. Some people give the religious answers. They say, God, you should let me in because I go to church every week, because I read the Bible, because I pray, because I try to treat others as I like to be treated myself. And that's why you should let me in. There is, I mean, am I wrong about this? There's an extraordinary belief inside each one of us, isn't there? That somehow if we can just do enough good things, then God will love me for it. He'll let me into heaven if he's there. I've just got to tick all the right boxes. That's what I've got to do. And that is exactly the mindset of this man as he's on his knees in front of Jesus in the dust. Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Well, how's Jesus going to respond to that? Be interesting to see. Verse 18. Why do you call me good? Jesus answered, no one is good except God alone. No one is good except God alone. In other words, says Jesus, if that is your mindset, if you think you can ever be good enough for God, you can forget it. Only God is truly good, and you will never be as good as God as long as you live, and no matter how hard you try, you will never be good enough for God, says Jesus. And that is outrageous, isn't it? That's outrageous to our thinking. We are so used to thinking of how good we are by comparing ourselves to other people. We compare ourselves to the people maybe we go to work with, some slightly difficult people we have in our own families, the people that we read about in the newspapers or see on the evening news. We compare ourselves to them and we think to ourselves, yeah, you know, we're basically good people. And if you've ever driven a car, if you're a driver like me, you'll know this is true. You'll know it's true. All those, we have a name, us drivers, we have a name for all those who drive faster than we do. They are called maniacs. And we have a name for all those who drive more slowly than we do. They are called idiots. And we have another name for those people who drive at exactly the same speed immediately behind us. They are called the police. But either way, we judge how good we are by comparing ourselves to the people around us, don't we? That's why we think we're basically good people. It is deeply offensive to be told by Jesus, no one is good. No one. And that's why Jesus does what he does in the next verse. He wants to give us a reality check. He wants to give us the litmus test to see how good we are in reality. Do you see that in verse 19? What he does is he summarizes the commandments, God's laws given directly to men, the true guide as to what God says is truly good. You know the commandments, he says in verse 19, do not murder, do not commit adultery, do not steal, do not give false testimony, do not defraud, honor your father and mother. But here is the striking thing. I wonder if you noticed it. Jesus doesn't give a complete list of the commandments here. He leaves some out. In fact, he deliberately leaves out what he calls in Mark chapter 12, the most important command of all. Why would he do that? And here it is. Here's the most important command, according to Jesus. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and all your mind and with all your strength. So why? Why would he leave out what he calls the most important command of all? A friend of mine recently bought me a gift certificate for my birthday. It entitled me to go scuba diving. I've got to say, I find it very uncomfortable being underwater for long periods of time. I get nervous going through car washes, and I had to be escorted from the cinema during Finding Nemo. But I soon discovered that one of the things that they do, you'll know this if you've done the scuba training, one of the things they do as part of the training is they simulate what it would be like to suddenly run out of air. It's terrifying. You're there, you're 5 meters under the water, and some guy goes behind you, twists the valve on the top of your tank, and suddenly you've got no air. And you know the way there are times in life when you go through periods of crisis, real panic moments, and at those times sometimes really bizarre things go through your head. Have you ever had that experience? And this is the thing, I'm slightly embarrassed to confess this to you, but this is the thing that went through my head at that precise moment. What kind of friend tries to drown you on your birthday? That was the first question, the first thing that went through my head. Then after that, all I could think about was the fact that I had no air. That was all I could think about. Some things become very conspicuous by their absence, very conspicuous. And that is exactly why Jesus leaves out some of the most important commandments right there in verse 19. He's leaving out the most important of God's commands in order to focus the man's attention entirely upon it. And here it is, the most important command of all, according to Jesus: love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. He wants this young man to examine his own attitude toward God. He may never have committed murder or adultery. He may never have given false testimony or defrauded anyone or stolen anything or dishonored his father and mother. But how's he treated God? How's he done with the most important command of all? Has he really loved God with all his heart, soul, mind, and strength? Really? It's not a very comfortable question for human beings, is it? It's not comfortable at all. And true to form, verse 20, the man tries to dodge the issue. It's a fascinating bit of psychology. Teacher, he declared, all these I've kept since I was a boy. You see, he would rather talk about the commands he thinks he has kept rather than talk about the ones he knows he has not kept. And here's the startling thing. He's bluffing God. He's bluffing. Of all the people to try and bluff, he's bluffing God. He's trying to dodge the issue. He's trying to steer the conversation away from this really uncomfortable issue. I've got a friend who used to get very nervous going to job interviews. And one of the most nerve-wracking interviews he said he ever had was when he was an A-level student reading English. And he went to a university to have an interview there to see if he could get a place on the course. And the first thing they asked him as he walked into the room was, who's your favourite author? And my friend said, Charles Dickens. They said, good choice. Isn't Oliver Twist the most remarkable novel? And my friend, not having read Oliver Twist, and having only seen the musical, did what any self-respecting interviewee would do in that point. He lied through his teeth. He absolutely lied. He tried to bluff the interviewer. He said, yes, it's the most remarkable novel, isn't it? They said, yes, it is. What's your favourite bit of the novel? My friend said, well, to be honest, there's so many good bits, aren't there, really? You know, I wouldn't want to put my finger on just one. It's just brilliant all the way through. And they said, yeah, but what's your favourite bit? And my friend took a deep breath, thought for a moment, looked them right in the eye, and said, with all the confidence he could muster, I think I'd have to go for the moment when everybody starts singing, you've got to pick a pocket or two. Now, this man in verse 20 is exactly the same. He keeps on trying to bluff Jesus, keeps on trying to pretend everything's okay. Teacher, he says, all these I've kept since I was a boy. And then we read what I think is the most stunning thing, perhaps the most stunning sentence in the New Testament. Verse 21, Jesus looked at him and loved him. Even as this young man tries to bluff Jesus, even as Jesus sees straight into his heart, knows exactly who he is and what he's done, knows exactly that he's broken the most important command of all, he still looks at him and loves him. Because at that moment, Jesus saw a young man for whom he knew he would have to die. It's not on your sheets, but let me just read it to you. This is verse 45 of that chapter. Jesus talks about himself. He says this, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, but to give and to give his life as a ransom for many. I don't know what your contact with Christianity has been up to this point, but just to say, right at the heart of Christianity is a very simple truth. It's the good news that Jesus Christ came into the world to express God's love for men and women who are not good enough for God. And Jesus demonstrates that love most supremely by dying on a cross. That's what he meant by saying, "I would give my life, I will give my life as a ransom for many." Because on the cross, Jesus died for people like this rich young man, for people like you, people like me, with all of our faults, all of our wrongdoings, all of our frailties, all of our failure to love God as we should. He died to pay the ransom that needed to be paid so that you and I could go free and enjoy the very thing this young man so badly craved, eternal life. You see, it is a, and I have to say this, it is a serious matter that we can never make ourselves good enough for God. We are separated from him, and the path we are on leads not to eternal life, but eternal death. It's what the Bible calls hell, and Jesus speaks about it frequently and seriously. But we're not without hope, because Jesus looks at us and loves us, even to the extent of dying for us. And because he is the only one who has ever lived who is good enough, he can pay the ransom you and I will never be able to afford, so that we can be forgiven by God, have the surpassing joy of knowing God, and the certainty of eternal life with God. But just in case this rich, young, powerful, religious man still harbors some deeply ingrained belief that somehow he can be good enough for God, just look at what happens in verse 21. It's the moment when the man's heart is laid bare, when we really see whether he really has managed to keep the most important command of all. "One thing you lack," Jesus said, "go, sell everything you have and give to the poor. And you'll have treasure in heaven. Then come, follow me." So there Jesus stands. He's offering the man the very thing he craves so deeply. He's waiting to welcome him. And then we read this. "At this, the man's face fell. He went away sad because he had great wealth." And this is the precise moment as he turns his back on Jesus, as he walks away up the road back to his old life. This is the moment when he reveals something profound about himself. Because this is the moment when he reveals how far he is from good and how far he is from God. He's far from good and far from God, because he has not loved God more than anything else. He has broken the most important command of all. He's not loved God with all his heart, soul, mind, and strength. How do we know that? Well, as we see here, there is something that he loves much more than God. He loves money much more than he loves the one who created him, the one who sustains him, who grants him every single breath he draws and every single pound coin in his bank account. He's putting something else before God in his life. And really, really, that is madness, isn't it? Because as he walks away from Jesus, as he walks away from the very thing, he's walking away from the very thing he craves most deeply. Jesus is offering him the treasure in heaven, the eternal life he's craved just a few verses before in verse 17. But right at the last, this man trades it all in. For what? For treasure on earth, the money, the career, the popularity, the respect of his peers, his personal sense of being a good person. He'd rather have those trifling, temporary things that within a few years will be turned to ashes. He would rather have those things than the glorious present assurance of endless joy. Endless life. Endless satisfaction. He makes the choice and he walks away sad. So as I close, let me ask you this lunchtime, what is it for you? I don't know you, obviously, but what is it for you? What's keeping you from the one who alone has the power to satisfy you? What is the one thing that you put before God in your life? What's the one thing that'll make you walk away from Jesus? Is it your youth? Is it some desire for power or money? Is it your personal sense of being a good person? Is it your reputation or your religion? I don't know, maybe it's family or friends or a certain physical relationship. I don't know, but what I do know is we don't need to bluff God anymore. For every time we've not been good, verse 18. For every time we've broken the commandments, verse 19. For every time we've put something else before God in our lives, verse 22. For all those things, Jesus has paid the ransom on our behalf so that we can be accepted by God and enjoy the all-satisfying relationship for which we were created to enjoy. He's done it all. The only thing we have to do is something that the rich young man could not do. Follow Jesus. Let me ask you to throw off whatever it is you're putting before God in your life and follow him. Follow him.